We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, December 7th, in the glorious future year of 2024. Remember the Maine. What do I have to tell you today? Well, the first thing is I'm coming to you by pre-recording. Actually, this is a test run of a script that I've written to do the recording all in one pass. This is going to be a very rough and ready show, just like my actual live shows, because I'm doing it live. I'm just doing it live to tape, as it were. And I'm pre-recording it because I'm going to be at the Coin Club's Christmas party. Why, at 19 UTC. And so I won't be able to do the show live to air, if that's the word. Now, what is there that I have to talk about today? Well, the first thing is I want to get you up to date with a few developments in terms of my continuing propaganda efforts. So I have made some more Merry Christmas badges with the Apollo 8 6-cent postage stamps on them. And I expect to take some of those to the Space Society Christmas party on Sunday. If you want one, do let me know. I also managed to beg some scraps of mat board from a local frame shop the other day, which will give me more colors to do coin cards with. And so I hope to get another batch of those made up very shortly. Again, the coin cards are typically something that I send out to people who send me some money. $5 will do it. You just have to let me know. Now, the really nice thing is, in addition to the U.S. 3-cent Atoms for Peace stamps, I have been able to get a small number of the Canadian 5-cent Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy stamps. So I will now have two major varieties of coin card to produce, the type with the U.S. stamp and the type with the Canadian stamp. So do let me know if you're interested in that. Let's see. I did acquire a 50 millimeter punch, which I am using to cut down the stickers that were misprinted by the vendor, with the design shrunk down, so I'm cutting those out. Unfortunately, the punch, it works fine on letter paper, but with cardstock it's a little iffy, and with the sticker, which of course is vinyl and then the backing paper, it just does not want to cut out more than about 3/4 of round. And so I have to go through this laborious process, and I'm going to take a photograph so you can see it, of using, basically, affixing the sticker with Scotch tape to a piece of cardstock that's already got the hole punched in it, because maneuvering the sticker around in the punch is difficult otherwise. Then using the punch to punch most of the sticker out, and then trimming it finally round with scissors. It's not perfect, it's time-consuming, but I don't want to throw away, 100 stickers that cost me, 50 cents a piece. so I'm cutting them down to a smaller size, and I'll probably send some out to my supporters in case you can find something useful to do with these smaller size stickers. Probably also going to use them as mailing seals or something on envelopes. Where the slightly smaller size is maybe convenient. I'm also trying to get a new batch of stickers printed, but so far that is proving a little tricky. Let's see. Oh, and I also, when I went to the office supply store to get the color print done for the Merry Christmas badges, I also got 15 sheets done, which makes 180 specimens, for the Atomic Power to the People pinback badges. And so I'm going to be assembling those over the next few days. And so I will have plenty of those the next time that they are called for. I think there is some kind of a local convention going on fairly soon, but I'm probably not prepared for it. Now, a very interesting development that came across my desk recently. I had been supporting somebody on Patreon who was doing various propaganda efforts under the umbrella term of Campaign for a Green Nuclear Deal. Anyway, and they said, well, you know, it looks like nuclear energy is now accepted by everybody, so I'm going to knock this off and go back to my regular job as an investment banker in a firm that is heavily interested in nuclear investments. Well, I personally think that is a bit over-optimistic. I genuinely believe that there is still quite a bit of work to do in promoting nuclear energy, and I'm going to continue doing that as part of my overall worldview, right? You know, space travel and nuclear energy are not simply ends in themselves, although both of them are lovely things. No, they are a part of an overall view of the world that we need to build. Anyway, so that's my continuing perspective on that. Now, a couple of interesting items in the news. Firstly, of course, by now you've probably heard that the CEO of United Healthcare, who is one step below the CEO of United Health, which is the overall organization, United Healthcare being the insurance arm of the business, was apparently assassinated in New York City the other day. And there's pretty much nobody shedding a tear for this guy. The American mode of delivering medical services, note that I will never call it a healthcare system, seems to be arranged specifically to create people with nothing to lose. And I'm just surprised we haven't seen this kind of thing before. And apparently, according to people who do bodyguarding for corporate executives, that kind of thing, healthcare executives get threats pretty much more than anybody else, but very rarely are these threats acted upon. Curious, but that's how it is. Anyhow, in other news, it's good to see that there are some countries in the world that value democracy. You know, we had a declaration of martial law in South Korea earlier in the week that only lasted about 7 hours. The declaration purported to suspend the National Assembly. 190 members of the National Assembly, including a number of members from the president's own party, managed to make it into the building, that's out of 300 total, where they held a vote in defiance of him and unanimously rejected the declaration of martial law, at which point he followed the Constitution and canceled it. That's very good news for South Korea. In France, an interesting piece of democratic action. Earlier in the year, President Macron called snap elections, although no one's entirely certain why. In the first round of voting, which doesn't actually allocate very many seats in the Chamber of Deputies, the far-right party led by Marine Le Pen, which was founded by her father purely, as far as I can tell, on the grounds that as a teenager in the 1940s, he thought that the Nazi occupation of France was really cool and the best thing that had ever happened to him. Well, the Le Pen front got a bunch of votes, with the result that all the other political parties organized to keep them out, which resulted in a lot of seats going to left parties. Macron, as a center-right politician with a center-right party, didn't understand what he was dealing with and appointed a center-right prime minister, the prime minister in the French system is a sort of delegate of the president, who hasn't been able to get anything done and threatened to ram the budget through without the approval of the Chamber of Deputies, at which point the Chamber of Deputies has held a no-confidence motion and gotten rid of him, which is the first time that's happened in 62 years. So now Macron has to come up with some other choice as prime minister and completely reorganize the government. But it is good to see people in France valuing democracy. Though I have to say, the prime minister was in Saudi Arabia, of all places. He was interviewed for the news, and he said, "Oh no, they'll never do that." And my immediate thought was, "Well, you've just jinxed it, mister. There's no better way to get a Frenchman to do something than to say he will never do it." Sheesh. If he's that competent, I'm not surprised. Vote of no confidence. Meanwhile, of course, here in the United States, we have to face the fact that many of our fellow Americans looked at what happened on January 6th, 2021 and said, yes, that's exactly what we want. Many of our fellow Americans looked at big signs saying mass deportations now and said, yes, that's exactly what we want. Many of our fellow Americans looked at Project 2025 and said, yes, that's exactly what we want. It really makes me wonder about my fellow American citizens. Do we truly not value the inheritance which has come down to us, which has made America a watchword in the world? That we can look with complete benignity and even acceptance on an attempt, quite open and brazen, to overthrow the constitutional order. We can look with acceptance and even approval on an absolutely ludicrous idea of policy concocted purely to harm people who are doing no injury to anyone. We can look with approval on an attempt, a plan, a very detailed and thoroughly worked out plan to reconstitute a kind of caste system in this country and completely undermine the idea of equal rights and equal protection under the law. I fail to understand how we can value our traditions and what we have received so little. It's extraordinary to me. I suppose part of it simply is that people don't believe they can be deprived of it. They assume it'll always be there. And that, my friends, is a very dangerous assumption. You assume that things have always been a certain way, and therefore they must be that way, and no little trivial choices you can make will change that. Ha! Let's see. Now, something on Jeff's show, Evolution Revolution, a comment that he made earlier in the week. He was talking about people, well, various things, but specifically about Wi-Fi in classrooms, and that some people were apprehensive that the microwave radiation of wireless internet connections would be harmful in some way to children, and that in the U.S. the lack of proof that this was true had been taken as a reason to do it, and in France the lack of proof that it wasn't true had been taken as reason not to do it. Now there are two things going on here. One of them is what people refer to as the precautionary principle. Now, there's really very little evidence for the so-called electrosmog theory that various electromagnetic radiations are making people sick or interfering with their brain function or anything of that kind. And, you know, the question becomes, what level of effects are you looking for, and at what level of exposure are you looking for them? Because, obviously, a milliwatt transmitter on the other side of the room is going to be very different from a 1-watt transmitter you're holding right next to your head. And if it's very difficult to detect any effect from the 1-watt transmitter being held next to the head, it seems reasonable to disregard the milliwatt transmitter across the room. But the major point, I think, is that people are likely to say, well, if we don't know what the effects are, then we shouldn't do it. And this is one of the major arguments that is deployed against the use of nuclear energy. People say, well, we don't really know what the risks and hazards and harms might be, so we better not do it. And, of course, what this does is twofold. The first is that it basically disregards the whole massive body of scientific knowledge that has been built up specifically about the effects of ionizing radiation. In fact, it's probably fair to say that we know more about the effects of ionizing radiation than on biological organisms than we know about pretty much anything else that's dangerous, probably up to and including bullets. But the second thing is that it elides the very real risks, harms, and hazards of other forms of energy production. If you have your choice between a very remote likelihood of some unknown harm from nuclear radiation and the very real fact of acid rain, people choking to death from coal smoke, and so on, it seems as though you would be morally required to choose the more remote and uncertain harm over the proximate and certain one. But that's not how people work, apparently. No, instead, we have this fascinating situation where, in order to get away from that risk evaluation, people behave as though the radiation has unique characteristics, that it's somehow its risks and hazards and harms of nuclear energy cannot be balanced against any other kind of risks, hazard, and harm. And that's very, very interesting, as I say, because it illustrates a possible lacuna in the way people think, that somehow this one category of agent that causes risks, hazards, and harms cannot possibly be weighed against any other, because there's something unique about it. That strikes one, I think, as, you know, when it's set out like that, it suddenly seems hard to believe. And this, again, is part of my overall argument that the people who oppose nuclear energy either are not doing so in good faith or are not doing so with a clear mind. Possibly both. Because when we take a clear-minded look at the arguments or claims that they bring forward against nuclear energy, we find that in many cases they are self-contradictory. Or else they just fall apart like wet tissue paper, that there's no substance to them at all. And it tends to make you wonder how the anti-nuclear intellectual conceptual framework or complex has become so widespread and so widely accepted, if it is something that, when looked at seriously, just doesn't hold water at all. But the other thing that I thought about with regard to this is, why in the devil are they talking about Wi-Fi in elementary school classrooms to begin with? Now, maybe Claudio M. has some insights on this, but basically, I keep hearing about, oh, well, we're going to have the kids have a tablet or this or that or the other thing. And each and every one of these things, I just keep thinking, you know, this isn't going to help, right? Because so far as I can ever determine, in each and every case, what's happening here is an attempt to solve the utter and dire brokenness of American schools, at least, I don't know about France, by bringing in instructional technology. Now, if you've been listening to my other show at 15 UTC Tuesdays and Fridays, you will have heard Buckminster Fuller's idea about the immense potential of television in education. But what does he say about it? Well, he says first and foremost that it has the power to bring the best teachers into the home. That most of a child's intellectual development occurs before the age of 4, on almost entirely in the home. And that television has the power to bring the best teachers into some kind of contact with those children, because it is clear that a good teacher is the most powerful force in assisting the child to learn and develop intellectually. Of course, a good teacher is not just someone who can explain things well. A good teacher also should be interacting with the student and should have compassion and should be able to interpret the cues that the student is giving in order to see what needs to be explained better, where more emphasis needs to be put, and so on. And of course, television can't do that. And people may want to try to use so-called artificial intelligence to do that, but they're not going to be very successful at it. The truth is, there is certainly a case for giving children networked computer appliances. But the truth is, the value in that is essentially in giving them access to an almost infinitely large library and letting them explore. I certainly believe in the let your children loose in a library model of learning and education. But the truth is, from my experience anyway, that having a teacher who knows the subject, having a teacher who is willing to act as a guide to the subject, is almost infinitely valuable even in those situations. And this is key, right? I'm speaking now as a pedagogue's nightmare. Nobody can teach me anything. But I can learn almost anything if I am sufficiently motivated and if the correct resources are set in front of me. I can learn pretty much anything. But try to teach me anything, and it's like pushing on a rope. Now, as a result, of course, I had a bad time in school, but that was certainly not the only reason I had a bad time in school. The American education system, such as it is, is not really well suited, I'm sorry to say, to the whole task of fostering intellectual development. I've often said that in the phrase compulsory education, the compulsory is more important than the education. That following rules, both written and unwritten, is far more important than any formal subject as far as what it is that they expect you to learn in these schools. Discipline. And discipline of a very peculiar kind, because there are many students who can act up and do all kinds of things who will not get in trouble for it. And I'm not talking about students with superior academic performance. I was one of them. And guess what? I was also bullied. And who got in trouble? Why, me, of course. Because being bullied is classed as disruptive behavior. Reacting to being bullied is disruptive behavior. And when the ultimate intent, right, when the outcome that is wanted is conformity and uniformity of action, then being disruptive is the worst sin and crime. We are talking about a school system, I hesitate to call it an educational system, which employs bullying as a bedrock part of the process. Bullies aren't punished because bullies keep the other kids in line. Effectively, they are like the trustees in a prison. Prisoners who bully other prisoners to make less work for the guards. It is a pathetic and saddening thought that most of the school teachers in American public schools are little more than prison guards. But I can tell you right now, they rarely know much of anything about the subjects that they're set to teaching. This is why American school textbooks come in two versions, one of them the teacher's edition, which has the answers in the back. I don't know that I can say anything more pathetic than that. I do recommend, though, if you want a better idea of how the system works, that you find a copy of a little paperback book entitled How to Survive in Your Native Land, which was written by a group of radical school teachers in New York City in the 1970s. Now, I don't necessarily agree with everything that they say, but it is illuminating. And sure, the 20 years or so between when they wrote and when I was in the schools, the more than 20 years that have passed since then, have changed some things, but I don't think they have changed the nature of the thing very much. So, to be frank, the best thing you can do with an internet-connected computer terminal in a school is to set the kids free to explore. But, at the same time, that is the one thing that the school authorities and the people back of them are very, very unlikely to want to do. And I wonder, of course, if that feeds into, then, the rejection, as I see it, of the American inheritance of democracy. Well, I'll leave you to think about that and just tell you that you can catch A Step Farther Out on a non-radio, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System, every Saturday at 19 UTC. And you can catch my other show, Hear Now the Words, also on a non-radio at 15 UTC, Tuesdays and Fridays. Please send your cards and letters of comment to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I will probably read what you send out on the air. I will probably send you something in return. If you appreciate these shows enough to want to support them, you could send money to paypal.me/PrometheusLives, or for a recurring contribution, patreon.com/man_and_Adam. Coming up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.
Five, four, three, two.